I want to thank everybody really for coming. It's been most enjoyable. Okay, but we'll what I want to do in today's class is today's class, whatever, in the Shir. I want to basically discuss the ninth chapter and how Purim becomes a holiday. We left off last week really that Esther's psychological manipulations of both Ahasuerus and Haman, inviting the party, not saying what's going on, to raise the suspicions of Ahasuerus against Haman. And of course, what is the giveaway is when Haman says what you should do to somebody you want to honor is let him ride on your horse and wear your clothes. And we explained that in the ancient world that got you with death penalty. And the Gemara, you know, talks about it. You're not allowed to wear the king's anything. And we discussed that the king is the only person who's not allowed to annul the honor due to him. A parent and a teacher can say, you don't have to honor me because it's their honor. You don't honor the king as a king. You honor the king because of the office of the king. And therefore, the king has no right to give up his authority. So even if he allows you to ride his horse, you're not allowed to ride his horse. Anyways, now Esther got a little lucky, so to speak. Her job was made easier because when Haman came out of the first party, or the first time he's going to go to the party, thank you, so he sees Mordecai. And again, Mordecai won't bow down to him. And again, he gets angry, like we had in the third chapter, right at the beginning. And that's, he comes home and realizes how sad in life it is. He's got everything going for him. And he says, but that old Jew won't bow down to me. It's not worth anything. It's like an amazing thing. But we do that all the time. You got everything. You know, you got everything. That Jew won't bow down to me. It's eino shoveli. It's not worth it for me. It's like an amazing statement. So his wife says, and all the friends say, build a gallows for Mordecai. Of course, had Ham, and then he goes to the king to tell him. Had that event not happened, had Mordecai not been there, it's unclear exactly what would have happened in the story. In other words, Esther, I'm not sure what plan Esther had, but it was a lot easier for Esther to carry her plan because, A, it allowed Ahasuerus to ask Haman, what should we do to someone we honor? And that revealed who Haman really was. That would not have happened had Haman not built the gallows. Secondly, when Esther finally reveals what the problem is, and she says Haman wants to kill the people, and Charbonah says, oh, the tree, you know, the one who wanted to save you, he built a tree to hang him, so Ahasuerus says, hang him instead. So that whole series of events, like everything in the Megillah, is really a series of coincidences. In other words, what was Esther thinking between party one, party two, we don't really know. She got lucky that Haman built the gallows, and he tried to hang Haman, and he basically hung himself, and left made Esther's job a lot easier. That's just sort of a side point to the story, but because we discussed last week, was Esther's original plan to invite Haman and Ahasuerus to a second party, or no? She really wanted to save the first party, but she didn't have the wherewithal to say it. She was too nervous. She was too nervous, so she pulled a delaying strategy. You know what? I'll tell you tomorrow. Now, why Ahasuerus didn't kill her, you know, he makes this whole thing, I have to see it right away, I have to come to the party right away, and then I'll tell you tomorrow. But that's very interesting. We don't know if that was part of the plan to make that second party to get Ahasuerus to think more, or she stumbled on the way. That's unclear, like a lot of things in the Megillah. Why Mordecai didn't bow down, why did Ahasuerus know, all these things. None of these stories are we don't know. The Megillah doesn't tell us because everything in the Megillah is hidden, Hester. That's the whole theme. It was Rabbi Grammer who pointed out yesterday, I never really thought of it that way, that we had a guest speaker over the weekend. He spoke on Megillah Hester a couple of times. So Megillah in Hebrew, so we translate it as the scroll of Esther. Megillah Hester, the scroll of Esther. But and we have discussed Hester from the word hidden, but Megillah really means in Hebrew, the galot is to reveal. Gilui arayot, our sexual sins, the revealing, you know, the intimacy. Megillat Esther is revealing which is hidden. That's what the name actually means. It's not the scroll of Esther. It's le galot et ha-hasmasha nistar, et Esther. So you're revealing the hidden. And that's, of course, that's the layer that we have to read it on if we want to know why Purim is a holiday, because otherwise this is a secular book about some partying in a kingdom, you know, like what made it a religious holiday. So that's what I want to pick up on today, looking at the ninth chapter, and then sort of see how it developed historically a little bit, and then maybe tie it into Pesach. So the ninth chapter is the chapter of where it says happened. Now, remember, Ahasuerus, of course, doesn't undo the decree. The decree to kill the Jews, it still stands. Haman is hung. Esther says, you know, our nation is in danger. So a normal person, a normal king would say, okay, he'll annul the decree that they sent out to wipe out Jews. We can't do that. Whatever is in the kingdom, this is part of the sort of, you know, the kingdom is the holy of holies. How Ahasuerus is replacing the kingdom with how the temple. So everything that comes out of the kingdom can never be changed, can never be moved. So he has to send out sort of a competing letter that the Jews can defend themselves. And of course, I think I mentioned this last week. That works, serves Ahasuerus very well to get basically a civil war going between the Jews and the Hamanites, whatever. And let them, you know, kill each other. What does he really care? But it's one that he says, I'm giving you the power. I'm giving the Jews to defend themselves. So what else could Esther and Mordechai ask for? They weren't going to get anything else. Remember, Ahasuerus says, I'll give you up to half the kingdom, right? Oh, that up to half means, you know, the unimportant stuff. And the rest I won't give you. Okay. So that's what happens in the ninth chapter. The Jews are happy. That's the end of the eighth chapter. And that's, of course, we say every Saturday night in Havdalah. That's, you know, like Dimaito or Rabbisim Chavis or Samikar, Kaintihi Alana. We add in, that should be for us too. But this is a pasuk in the Megillah. And, of course, the custom is we read this out loud. You know, there are four verses we read out loud in the Megillah. Ishu Deaya B'Shushan Habira. There was a Drew or in Shushan Habira, Ushmo Mordechai. Except for then we read, like Dimaito or Rabbisim Chavis or Samikar, Kaintihi Alana. What's the other one that's right around here too that I'm forgetting now? Oh, but right before, Ir Shushan Sahala B'Samecha, before the city of Shushan was happy. Remember when Haman issued the decree? So Mordechai and Haman, they sit down to eat. Remember we spoke about the right at the beginning, just like Yosef's brother, they sat down to eat. Ir Shushan Navocha, and the city of Shushan was all confused. The Moran Nebuchim, the guide of the perplexed, Yershon Navocha. And here, Yershushan Sahala V'Samecha. Now, the city of Shushan, now that's a very interesting expression. What does it mean, this city? The city was happy. What do you mean the city was happy? The Jews, the non-Jews, the city itself? So it's like, I can guarantee you, I can guarantee you it's not going to happen, but if it would happen, if the Leafs would win the Stanley Cup, say, the city of Toronto is rejoicing, right? After 52 years? After 52 years, the city of Toronto is rejoicing, right? That's how people talk. What does that mean? When you say a city is rejoicing, it means everybody is rejoicing. Is that really true? Where, in other words, was this a story of the Jews or the non-Jews? So again, the Megillah doesn't tell us. It makes sense that the people in Shushan are confused as everybody. Because what in the world are they getting a letter to wipe out all the Jews? It's very strange, like for no reason. There's no background, there's no history of anti-Semitism here, like there's nothing going on. So if that could be everybody. So here it sounds like it's more a Jewish thing. This is like Mordechai and Esther, Yer Shushan, but I don't know, presumably Yer Shushan is both. And what are they happy about? They shouldn't be so happy because there's going to be a war on the 13th of Adar. Like they know in advance. It's like an amazing thing. Like you declare war like 8 months in advance. The fact that Mordechai, in other words, what does Haman do? On the 13th of Nisan, he says, we're going to kill the Jews on the 13th of Adar. That's why 13 is an unlucky number. I have no idea. I just made that up. But, right? The 13th of Nisan to the 13th of Adar, exactly 11 months later. It's also strange. Until the 13th of Adar, you can't kill any Jews. That would be a terrible thing to do. All right, then Haman broke his own thing. Like, he wanted to kill Mordechai. He had enough already, right? Mm-hmm. So they announced. Now, by the way, this is quite fascinating. Remember, this story is happening on Pesach, we discussed. Remember, because it's the 13th of Nisan, the 3 days of fasting. The last part of the story happens extremely quickly. The first part of the story takes actually 9 years to develop. Year 3, the story begins. Year 7, Esther is appointed queen. Year 12, Haman becomes the chief of Homeland Security. And then he establishes the decree. But most of the story takes place right those 2 days, and then you have a break till the 13th of Adar. So basically over Pesach, the decree is overturned. So when if you look in chapter 8, I think we're chapter 8, verse 9, when do they send out the letters? When are these letters? When are the letters sent out?
The third month.
Isn't that strange? Right? The 23rd day of Sivan. Like, where does that come from?
Yeah.
In other words,
2 months later.
More than 2 months later. What was going on 2 months? So I have no idea. Again, in other words, it's just very strange. Haman's letters went out immediately. Haratzim yatsu dechufim yadamel. Now here too, it says, I don't think it has that language that they went out quickly. It just said, but it's very interesting that didn't go out till the 23rd of Sivan. I don't know what the significance of 23rd of Sivan is. If somebody has an idea, please let me know. Anyway, so from the 23rd of Sivan till the 13th of Adar, we're sort of, everybody's waiting. Nothing's happening. But from Nisan, in other words, the people are, I don't know, they're happy. That's what it says. La'idim, the Jews are happy. So what do you think there? It's also funny. Like, they're happy, but they know they have to go to war, like in 8 months, whatever. But okay. And it says, at the last verse in chapter 17, lots of people are converting to become Jewish. It's cool to be Jewish. Rabbi me'ameh ha'aretz mit yahadim. It's like a made-up word. It's the last verse in chapter 8. U'bechol medina medina, b'chol ir v'ir, in every province, in every city, mekom asher dvar avdato magia, every place where the word of the king comes, simcha b'sason liyudim, joy and happiness, mishtev yom tov, they're drinking and having a yontif, whatever yontif means, a good day, rabim, and many, me'ameh ha'aretz, from the people of the land, mityahadim, are becoming Yehudim, are becoming like Jewish, because they were afraid. They're afraid of the Jews. The Jews are now all powerful. They're in command. Now, I guess everybody knows Esther's the queen. Esther is Jewish. And Mordechai is appointed the second man. The Jews are controlling everything. But instead of fighting, they want to join the Jewish people. Instead of being jealous, they're happy to join the Jewish people. By the way, this is a... Okay, yeah, so that's everybody... I mean, because... According to Jewish law, you're really only supposed to convert when things are bad for the Jews. I don't know. In other words, the Gemara raises the question, are you allowed to convert when things are really good for the Jews? Because maybe you're not converting because you want to convert. You're converting because you want to make more money or whatever, because it's really cool to be Jewish. So there really is an idea that the Gemara says in the time of Shlomo HaMelech, when it was sort of ideal for the Jewish people, that they didn't accept converts. We haven't let people. It's like, whatever, that's just an interesting point. Okay. So now, the heir of Rav, maybe? So the heir of Rav that left with Egypt, they didn't convert as far as we know. I mean, I don't know that there was they didn't have the concept of conversion, I don't think, back then, like the way we have it today. It says in the Torah that people from Ammon and Moab can't convert, right? And the Egyptians can't convert for three generations. We discussed Ammon and Moab can't convert. But I don't know what that means exactly. What was the process of conversion initially? But it really meant, I mean, there's no matter if you look in the Talmud, what's the first thing we tell a convert when they come to convert? It's actually pretty easy. I mean, in theory, conversion is simple. It can be done in 5 minutes. The Gemara just says you teach very little, but the first thing you tell a convert is not, are you going to be an observant Jew?
Is it just try to discourage them?
Yeah, how do we discourage them?
Are you sure? You question?
No, why? How do we do this? So, no, there was a formula. We say, you need your head examined. Why do you need your head examined? Holocaust, pogroms, terrorism. Well, what are you, nuts? You want to be Jewish for? Do you know what Jewish history, all the terrible things of Jewish history? And then he says, no, I know, but the Jewish people are such an amazing people. I want to join these people, you know, who produce the most marvelous people and so made so much contribution to the world. In other words, it's all about identifying as a Jew. And only then, and that's how Rabbi Soloveitchik, you know, developed it. The first thing we want is, do you identify as a Jew? Do I feel the pain of Jewish history and I rejoice in the joys of Jewish history? And then you teach him there's six mitzvot, the Talmud lists off. Could be in the ancient world, people knew what it meant to be Jewish. Like, it's very hard to know, like, how does that apply today? Because today people don't even know what it means to be an observant Jew. But everybody knew a Jew had a brief milah. That, like, everybody knew. That's what Catholicism, you know, Christianity did away with that to get a lot more people. That's very simple. If you want to get a lot of people to join your religion, you don't make adults have a brief milah. Like, that ain't going to work. So by having people make a brief milah, like, you know, you're not going to have so many people coming over. So they probably knew on Shabbat, whatever, but the Talmud says the Talmud specifically mentions actually six mitzvot we teach a convert. Anybody want to guess what they are?
No.
That's probably assumed. Oh. That they kept their basic human being. But six specific mitzvot relating to being Jewish. They're six. They're not the ethical mitzvot. That's in the...
I believe Hashem's... Hashem Echad, Shema.
The Rambam adds that. That's not in the Talmud. Nothing on belief in the Talmud. The Rambam, who is the person who put belief at the forefront of Judaism, that's for another series of lectures. But the Rambam... It was the Rambam, really, who codified the notion of belief, the 13 principles of faith. Mm-hmm. The Gemara talks very little about belief. How do you know what a person believes, even if they tell you? It's another. Mm-hmm. Right. So the Gemara doesn't mention anything about belief. The Rambam, when he writes about conversion, says you have to teach him about there's one God, etc. But that's not in the Talmud. Okay. I'll give you a hint. Root.
Sorry?
Root.
Me, yeah.
Oh, no, I meant root. Root Hamoavi.
Yeah,
Ruth, the Moabite woman.
That's me.
Leket, Shichacha, Peya, Maser Ani. So that's the first four. Leket, if a farmer drops something, means he has, I have so much wheat, I can't carry it all. So I drop some, I can't pick it up. I have to leave it for the poor.
Yeah.
Shichacha, I've got 98 fields, and I don't remember Tarvis one. I don't remember a bank account in Switzerland. I have so much money. You can't access that bank account, leave it for the poor. I mean, I don't know if it's true by money, but whatever, you get the idea. If you forget about it, you have to leave it. You can't remember, I forgot that field. You got to leave the whole field for the poor. So, and Peya, you have to leave a corner of the field, whatever. So those three, and that's how Ruth became Jewish, which Ruth is the model convert, because Ruth went to the field, didn't have any food, they were very poor, Boaz's field, she converted. So it's tying in the importance of giving to others, which of course is a major message of Megillat Esther, Mishloach Manot and Matanot Levyonim. It's the same idea, helping others. So the mitzvah identifies a Jew, give basically charity, and Maser Ani is that the farmer has to give an extra 10% of his produce to the poor in the third and the sixth year. We don't have to go into all the details, but it's a form of tzedakah. So there's our four of the six. And then we get to two ones that everybody knows, Shabbat and Kashrut. That's it. That's all you have to teach him. And tell him, last week, you could go driving in your car, you could do whatever you want on Shabbat, go to McDonald's on Saturday afternoon and enjoy a cheeseburger. Nothing wrong. You become Jewish, you go in the car to McDonald's for a cheeseburger, you're finished, buddy. So, are you sure? No, that's how the Talmud presents it, without getting into it now, or another time, but you know, in theory, never in practice, but in theory, there was a death penalty under certain circumstances for the violation of the laws of Shabbat, because in the time of the Talmud, and until 200 years ago, until 1861, I can put the exact date when in rabbinic literature this changed, until 1861, the notion was, that a Jew who violated the Shabbat meant he didn't believe in God. That's what it meant, because we keep Shabbat because we believe God created the world. That's the basic reason. Mm-hmm. So if you violate the Shabbat, it means you don't believe in God. So the violation of Shabbat was associated with non-belief. So a Jew who publicly, not privately, a Jew who publicly desecrated the Shabbat was warned in advance with witnesses and said, I don't care, I don't believe in any of this stuff. Then, and he was brought up in a religious environment, blah, 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 and he knows better, etc. So in theory, it was probably never done in history. I'm sure it was never, ever done in Jewish history, was given a death penalty. But that's what you tell him in the Talmud. Like, before you convert, you lay down what it says in the books. Now we're going to do in practice. So that's scary a little bit. Like, mm-hmm. you know, you better make sure you want to be, you know. And then that's really then. We tell them you can be a wonderful person. You don't have to be Jewish. You don't have to be Jewish. But anyways, here we are converting. So I don't know that they gave them Hilchot Shabbos and Kashrut there. Mm-hmm. I mean, remember, the Jews are eating at the party of Achashverosh. That's how the Megillah begins. And the rabbis, it's not, you know, it's not the simple meaning of the text, not even the text. The rabbis say that's why they were punished. Why did the Jews of that generation almost get destroyed? Because they enjoyed the meal, the food at Achashverosh's party. Now remember, and v'chelim, v'chelim, shonim, right? And the vessels at the party, we spoke, were, according to the rabbis, the vessels of the temple. So here we are, the temple is destroyed 50, 60 years earlier. And Achashverosh is partying using the vessels that were sitting in Jerusalem in the Holy of Holies, whatever, in different parts of the temple, not in the Holy of Holies, but and he's, you know, partying from that, and the Jewish people are dancing and singing. So that was pretty unacceptable. But unless they ordered, even if they ordered kosher food, which I doubt very much that Achashverosh is partying, although who knows? Yes, you have a question?
No, I just said, from where would they order it?
Well, where did the Jews get kosher food? I don't know. Where did the Jews get kosher food?
Tovli.
They made their own food. I don't know.
They called Tovli.
They didn't have to wait 6 hours between meat and milk. And by the way, at that point, chicken wasn't considered meat. You could eat chicken and milk together. That was only a later development.
What a mistake.
Baruch Hashem.
More seriously.
I thought this is, it's Purim. Purim's all about joking.
Okay. So my question, will, I promise, will be silly. So, I mean, we're supposed to be getting messages from here because it's just a story if we have to look, you know, within. So I actually don't get this part that we're reading about the Shushanites, they're becoming Jewish and whatever, because the appeal is to be on the winning side of the battle.
Right.
And to have
That's what I'm pointing out. It's
to plunder. Which the Jews were granted the opportunity to do.
And they didn't do it.
But we know that.
Maybe other people, right. So I'm pointing out everything in the Megillah is upside down. V'nahafochu. We haven't really spoken about that. But that's v'nahafochu asher yishtetu ha-yehudim b'soneim. The Megillah, that's, you know, v'nahafochu ha-yehudim heima b'soneim. It's one of like the big songs for Purim. Like, things were nahafoch. We turned it upside down. And the Jews were in power. Asher yishtetu ha-yehudim, they were a sholeit, they were the ones who ruled over the other people. So people wanted to be on the winning side. Right, this probably wasn't done because they were so, they wasn't done for reasons, lishma, for ideal reasons, for the sake of heaven. It's done for personal reasons. I'm just pointing out in the Megillah, they're all converting, but that's not really what I want to focus on. But if you look in the Megillah, in the ninth chapter, so this is what happens. The 13th of Adar arrives. That's what it says. Beyom asher shibruei ve'yudim, in this first verse, Lishopem, it's what I just quoted. V'nahafochu asher yishtetu ha'yudim heima b'soneim. This is the day where the Jews are going to take over and, you know, be the rulers against their enemies. Nikalu ha'yudim b'areim, the Jews gather together. Kahal, right? A kahal coming together, which is the main theme of Purim, right? To fight against people. People were afraid of the Jews. The Jews were, you know, the psychology is more important than the real thing often. Okay, they're all afraid and they loved Mordechai. Ki gadol Mordechai beveit hamelech. Mordechai was great. What does this sound like?
Joseph.
We discussed Joseph. Who, not so much Joseph, and also, but this idea that Mordechai was great. They were afraid, but they had nothing against Mordechai. Does it sound like they liked Mordechai? By Moshe, I think. Mm-hmm. You look in the Chumash, when they're having the Esther Makot, it says, Ki ish Moshe gadol b'nei Mitzrayim. I don't remember the exact quote, but Moshe, the Egyptian people loved Moshe. They liked Moshe. They thought he was a great guy. Hmm. In other words, it's like the Egyptian people saw that Paro is being an idiot. Like, Moshe is a great guy. They're not, and they gave the Jewish people gifts when they left. If you remember, they left. They said, and here, take gold and silver, and they left them there. We worked for 400 years. And why does the Torah do that? So this is a beautiful idea, that our last memory of Egypt is meant to be that the Egyptian gave us gifts as we left. And how does the Torah always say to remember Egypt? be kind to the stranger, because you were strangers. Egypt becomes the place where we became a great nation. We don't look down. We don't say, oh, they tried to kill us. That's not how we remember Egypt. Remember, Egypt is a place that was the incubator of Jewish history, and therefore we have to remember it to be kind to people. We know what, we suffered a little bit. We know what it's like to suffer. Don't make other people suffer. But the memory of Egypt is meant as a positive memory, and the Egyptian people are allowed to convert only three generations later. There was that first generation, needs time. There was too much whatever, like tension, but a couple generations later, the Ammon and Moab could never convert, because they wouldn't give us bread and water in the desert. And that's not to show basic human decency. We don't want anything to do with you people. Especially since Ammon and Moab are descendants of Lot. And Lot, Avram is the one who saved Lot. So they had a sense of gratitude. They had no historical debt to what we had done. So we're going to ignore them for history. And that's Ruth is the Moabiah, because Ruth's a woman. And that was only the men couldn't convert. The women were allowed to convert. That's for another time. How long do you want us to stay tonight? I'm in no hurry, It's okay. Anyway, so let's go on. So here you have Bayakua Yudim B'chol Eveim. I'm just quickly going through in the ninth chapter. They killed 500 people. And then, of course, the ten sons of Haman. I'm not going to say it here, but I'm not a big fan of these. I don't go for it. But if anybody knows anything on the Bible codes, this was like the first Bible code ever said, as far as I know. If you look in the 10 sons of Haman, you notice in every Megillah, Parshtanta, the second word, Parshandata, the second name, notice how the Tav is small. Mm-hmm. And you notice that in Parmashta, in verse 9, the Sheen is small. Yeah. And you notice Vaizaita, the Zion is small. This has been printed in every Megillah, I guess, for 2,000 years. Every Megillah, for reasons that are not clear. The custom of the Sofrim of write the Megillah is to put those three letters small. We have no idea. This is the famous Bible code, whatever. So, Tav Shin Zion. Those are the three letters. Is what? What year is Tav Shin Zion? 1947. So that was the year that there were 10 Nazis were hung in the Nuremberg trials. So this Tav Shin Zion is a reference, to the Nuremberg trial, the 10 children of Haman who were hung. Anyways, take it for what it's worth or not worth, whatever. And of course, I don't know if there's a whole development of the Bible predicting the future, but I don't go for that stuff. We follow the Bible not because it makes, we follow the Bible because it's a moral ethical book. It teaches how to live our life. This is cute, but it's nothing to get excited about.
The Nazis, before he was hung, said Purim 1947. Right.
That's right. I forgot that piece. Thank you very much. I didn't notice. You came in. Hello. Well, classmates from high school. We were in high school together. I won't say how many years ago, but many years ago, before you were born. Okay. So many years ago. That when one of them was killed, he yelled out a Purim fest. Apparently, that was recorded by non-Jewish newspapers. They don't know why. When they yelled out, Purim Fest, 1947.
Who yelled it out?
One of the ones who was killed. I forget
Julian
now.
Stryker.
There you go. Thank you very much. Right, thank you. Okay.
It was also the year that Israel was...
Israel was declared, right? Okay. Anyways, it's just a little cute thing. Make of it what you'd like. I just figured I'd point out something interesting. If you don't remember anything else, you have something. A cute thing. It's hard, Okay. Let's get to the story of Megillah, and I want to get into Pesach a little bit, because Purim leads into Pesach. Okay. So, when does the story begin? So, by Yudim Asher B'Shushan. Okay.
Where is this?
Ushar HaYudim. No, we're in verse 15. Okay. Okay, in verse 16, the people went to war. They went on the 13th. They rested on the 14th day. This is verse 17. Vaso oto yom mishteh v'simcha. The people outside of Shushan made Purim a yom mishteh v'simcha, a day of drinking, or I don't know necessarily drinking, although mishteh lishtah, but it means a day of partying. And Simcha, a day of joy. Vayudim, verse 18, Vayudim Asher B'Shushan, but the Jews in Shushan, Nikalu B'Shlosha Sarbo, Ubar Barsabo, they had an extra day, they rested on the 15th day, and they made it a Yom Mishteh V'Simcha. So historically what happened is the Jews outside of Shushan made the 14th a party day, and the Jews in Shushan made the Jews the 15th a party day. Now comes the next verse. Not complete. Al kein, therefore, verse 19, Hayudim haprazim, this Jews who live in open cities, haprazim, Hayoshvim barei haprazot, that's a repetitive phrase, right? The ones, the open cities, Jews who dwell in the open cities, Osim et yomar basar lechodesh adar simcha u'mishta v'yontov. They make the 14th of Adar simcha u'mishta. That's nice. That's what we just read. But they also make it a yontov. In addition to simcha, whatever yontov means, in the Bible, yontov means you can't do work. Yontov means it's a day of rest, like Pesach Shavuot. Like it's almost like a Shabbat, not quite. You can cook. But that's what yontov means in the rest of the Bible. Whether that's what it means here, I don't know. But it says they made it yontiv, and what else? Umishloach manot ish l'reyehu, and sending gifts to one another. That's always the Jewish way. What about the people in Shushan? What do they do? That's the right answer. Nothing. Nothing. They did nothing. The Megillah, it's very strange. Why? Some say they didn't feel the threat, and they live in one city. They never felt danger. Whatever it is, the people in outside of Shushan made a party. People in Shushan didn't make a party. That's how it started. The people started. Then in verse 20, Vaychtov Mordechai. So Mordechai writes this all down. Vaychlech Svarim. That's what they do in the Persian Empire. They send books. Akola Yehudim. Only to the Jews. Verse 20. Asher b'chol medinot ha-melech ha-krovim v'ha-rechokim. Those near and those far. Presumably Shushan. Sent Jews all 127 provinces. To do what? L'kayem aleihem, that they should establish among themselves the odosim et yom arbasar l'chodesh adar vet yom chamisha asar b'chol shana v'shana. So Mordechai establishes a two-day holiday, the 14th and the 15th of Adar. Mordechai joins the two, does not make a distinction between Waw cities and non-Waw city. Every Jew in the world observes the 14th and the 15th b'chol shana v'shana, every year, two-day holiday. Like the day, we say this at the Seder, So what does Mordechai do? He flips Yontif and Matanot Levyonim. There's no longer a Yontif. Purim is no longer a Yontif. It's a regular work day. People go to work on Purim. I mean, it's nice if you can take it off, but lots of people go to work on Purim. But you have Matanot Levyonim. This is the first time we hear. Before we have Mishloach Manot, he has Matanot Levyonim. I just thought that's interesting. I don't think it's really a switch. In other words, the people observe the Yontif, and Mordechai says, instead of Yontif, we're going to have Matanot Levyonim. What does that tell us? That the purpose of Yontif is Matanot Levyonim. And the Rambam writes that one of the obligation of Yontif is to make sure, the first obligation of Yontif, what's the first law in Hilchot Pesach? This is already in the Shulchan Aruch. The first law and the laws of Passover. Anybody know? If you open up a Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law, the laws of Pesach are big. They take up a big chunk of law. I don't have to tell you that. Right? So what's the first law of the laws of Pesach? You know the first laws? That we collect money before Pesach because it's an expensive holiday. The poor people can't afford the... You know, matzah is supposed to be poor man's bread, but it makes you poor. $28 a pound or whatever they charge for handmade shor matzah, whatever. Like, so it's too expensive. So we have to collect money. That's the first law in Hilchot Pesach. That's right. And the Rambam writes the person who sits down in Yontif eating his meal and he doesn't give to the poor. That's not a Yontif meal. He's parting for himself. So I think it's actually interesting. The Jewish people said Yontif, and Mordechai said Matanot Levyonim. So, of course, it's not the same, but in a sense, it is the same. Whereas Mordechai just took was a Yontif, and he redefined the Yontif as Matanot Levyonim, gifts to the poor. But right now, we have a two-day holiday for every Jew around the world. By the way, what's missing? What don't you have to do? You don't have to read the Megillah. There's no reading of the Megillah. There's no Megillah here. The party is Mishteh, Yontif. When you're having a mishteh and yontif, you don't want to go to shul and hear a Megillah for half an hour. Like, that ruins the party. You know, like, let's party. Who wants to hear the Megillah? No, in other words, mishteh, yontif, and I'm busy giving gifts to the poor, mishloach, that's not the day for religious gathering in shul to hear a whole long story. I know the story, you know. So there's no Megillah reading. Okay. V'kibbel la'yudim. First, and the Jews accepted. V'kibbel la'yudim. Elecher hechelu la'sot. That's what they had started to do. Because remember, it's the Jewish people who started to observe the holiday. And only afterwards Mordechai writes it down. Right? Edeshirta Mordechai. Ki hamdam dem data. What he wanted to kill us. He peeled poor. B'val ibn ha-melech. Verse 24, 25. It recounts the story very quickly. We won't go into that now. V'talu oto. They hung him. Alken karuli mime lepurim. Hashem apur. Exactly. Kimu v'kiblu. Again, the Jewish people in verse like 27. They accepted them. Aleim bal zaram. For them and their children. Purim is no longer just, maybe it was a temporary holiday for the people in Shushan. No, it's a permanent Jewish holiday for all people, always. Aleihem v'azaram v'akolon l'vim aleihem v'lo yavor. It should never pass. And you know what the Midrash says? The Midrash says that in the Messianic era, we'll have only one holiday. Purim. No Pesach, no Sukkot, no nothing. I don't know what that means. It contradicts basic Jewish theology, that Medrash, but whatever it means. But the Medrash does say that Purim will be the only, there's something special about Purim. Something very special about Purim.
Wasn't Hanukkah also, that they said
Hanukkah is later. Hanukkah is a few hundred years later. And we don't have a text for Hanukkah. There's a thing, you know, we have a Megillah for Purim. We could have had Megillat Esther in Tanakh. And no holiday at Purim. Like there's the book of Yonah, there's the book of, we have all these books. We don't have a holiday for every book in the Bible. We have the book of Ruth. Do we have a holiday for the book of Ruth? No. We have a custom to read Ruth on Shavuos, which not every shul does. It's not, Ruth is not what Shavuos is. The book of Shir HaShirim. Do we have a holiday to read the book of Shir HaShirim? We have the book. So who needs a holiday? So we could have had Megillat Esther. It's just an interesting book in Tanakh with no holiday. Or we could have had a holiday with no book in Tanakh, like we do on Hanukkah. We have a holiday. There's no book in the Bible for Hanukkah. But yet it's, and the Rambam joins it together, Hilchot Purim and Hanukkah, the two rabbinic holidays. So it's interesting, but Purim ended up with both. And the Talmud talks about that Esther first writes to the rabbis, Kitvuni l'dorot, or Kivauni l'dorot, establish me as a holiday. And the rabbis say, no, we don't want to make Purim a holiday. And she has a whole fight back and forth, and Esther wins, and then Esther says, okay, Kitvuni l'dorot. This is the name of this book that I have here, Kitvuni l'dorot. Write me for all generations. That Esther sent a letter to the Chamim, write me down in Tanakh. And the rabbis said, what, are you crazy? Write down Tanakh. This book's going to go in our Holy Bible? We don't need this book. You want to tell me about enemies? We read about Amalek on Shabbos. We have enough stories about enemies. And the Torah says, we don't have to arouse the enmity of the nations. They'll be jealous. We're gloating that we want them. We don't want this book in the Bible. It's a fascinating thing. Again, we don't have time to develop why it became a book in the Bible. And for hundreds of years, there's a debate, what's called in rabbinic legal literature, whether Esther mitameh hayadim. You know, you're not allowed to touch a sefer Torah. You know, you're not, right? If every scroll you take, like a talis or something, you don't want to touch with your bare hands. That's a custom. So the question is, now we do touch Megillat Esther with our bare hands, because it's a Megillah. It's considered an igaret. It's considered a letter, right? The custom is, you have, you roll up the Megillah, you touch it with your bare hands. It's not the same thing, but whether even it brings impurity to the hands, whatever. So that, there's a whole debate whether really Esther had the holiness of the rest of the Bible. Obviously, it becomes part of the Bible, and Purim becomes a major holiday. And a beloved holiday. So that's what's going on now. B'chol shana v'shana. So v'yamim me'ela, verse 28. The niskarim v'nasim, they're remembered. So that's the Talmud says is a reference to reading the Megillah. But that's where the Talmud gets the idea. Niskarim. You have to remember it by reading it. But that's not really the simple meaning of the verse. V'nasim b'chol dor v'dor, mishpacha, mishpacha, medina, medina, ir v'ir. Again, Purim lo yavru mitocha yudim. They will never depart from the Jewish people. Zikram lo yosum yisram. And their memory will never end from their descendants. And then again, verse 29, Esther Hamalka bar Avichayel Mordechai Yehudi. They wrote this all down to write Purim again hashenit, the second time. There was clearly resistance here. The Megillah is hinting at something. L'kayem ha-igeret, igeret ha-purim, that's what we just said, a letter. The Megillah is considered the status of a letter. That's why, by the way, if you're ever, when you want to train to be a sofer, a scribe, the scribes always train on Megillat Esther. Because you make one letter missing in a Sefer Torah, the Sefer Torah is theoretically invalid. If the Megillah, you can have up to 49% can be missing, mistakes, it doesn't matter. When you write a letter, it doesn't have to be so exact. So you mispronounce the word here. Not a big deal. So and God's name isn't there, so there's not problem racing. So that's why the suffering always like practice. You know, it's there. It doesn't matter if they're missing words or missing letters.
He's not suggesting that we read Megillah with 49%.
No, no, of course not. No, no, but I'm saying it's an Iger. It has a different status. It doesn't. But why does Esther? We just read over and over again how the Jewish people accepted it. And by the way, we never see in the Megillah the split that we have today between Jerusalem, Shushan. That's not in the Megillah. That's the first story. It's not here. But Esther has to write again, the second time. Very unclear. There's some problem with Megillah Esther. That's what the rabbis are picking up on, right? By Shlach Svarim, and again, I mean, Rabbi Grummet gave a whole shiur on this, which you don't have time to go over, but I'm just pointing it out. By Shlach Svarim, he sent letters again to all the people, 127, Divrei Shalom Ve'emet. Words of peace and truth. Now, the same, we know that peace and truth are contradictory. I mean that's the Medrash says right away from the beginning of the world. The Midah, the attribute, God's attribute of truth, said, "Don't create the world. You're creating man's a bunch of lies all through his teeth. Man is just a bunch of liars. When are you creating a world for a falsehood? We call this an olam. We call you when you die, you go to the olam ha'emes, the world of truth. This is an olam sheker." The world of falsehood and people cheat and get ahead and right. So the attribute of truth. What a creating world. The attribute of peace. That's a whole different story. Peace and if you want peace, if you're gonna demand ultimate truth, you can't have peace. If you demand everything that's yours, you know, truth, you won't have peace. And in order to make peace, you have to give up on the truth a little bit. Aaron HaKohen is the in our tradition. Aaron, Moshe's brother. Oev Shalom Verodev Shalom. And he was known, that's the example. You can lie a little bit. They want to make up. They didn't really mean it for peace. The Talmud says you're allowed to lie. I tell a white lie to promote peace. Peace is more important. But the Divrei Shalom Ve'emet really are their intention. I don't want to say they're not always in contradiction, but they're often intention. Anyways, again, to keep Purim again. Okay, then we get to chapter 10, which is, I discussed, I think, the first week, what's Purim holiday? The story ends. Mas, taxes. Vayasem HaMelech HaShveirosh, Mas, Al Kol Haaretz. Remember, he lowered taxes early in the Megillah because he was a weak king. He wanted to be popular. So he made parties and he lowered taxes. Now it's 9 years later, probably already 10 years later. I mean, it's 10 years later. He's still there. Doesn't worry. Got rid of now he's raising taxes, he's growing his empire. He doesn't have to worry, he's raising his taxes. And everything you want to read more about Mordechai, it's written in the Persian, in the Persian's book, I guess the same book that Achashverosh was reading when he couldn't go to sleep. Ki Mordechai Yehudi, and that's how he's introduced. Most time he's only Mordechai, but when we first issue Hudi Ayabushan of Yerosh Mordechai, so again at the end, Mordechai Yehudi Mishneh, Lemelech Achashverosh. So I have a custom. I read the Megillah every year. That's I've been doing it for a number of years. So I picked this up, Jeff Weiss. I heard him do it years ago, and it's a beautiful custom to explain. So this is how I read the last verse of the Megillah. Ki Mordechai ha-Yehudi Mishneh la-Melech ha-Chashveirosh V'gadol ha-Yehudim v'ratzui l'rov echav Doresh tov li'amo v'dover shalom l'chol zaro. What are we getting ready for?
Adir hu.
Pesach. Now, that's not a coincidence. Why are you doing it? Because we spoke already about how Pesach and Purim are opposites. One is totally God and Moshe's missing. One is totally man and God is missing. They come together, the two form. It depends if the Ramah, the Shulchan Aruch. I said the first law in Hilchot Pesach, you have to give to the poor. So there are two parts of the Shulchan Aruch. That's the first part in one of them. The first part of the other one is Shloshim Yom Kodem Achag, the 30 days before Pesach, you have to start learning about Pesach. When's 30 days before Pesach?
Purim.
It's not a coincidence. 30 days before, in other words, on Purim, you have to start learning about Pesach. Now, let's do one cute one more. I mean, we discussed a lot of the analysis. Now, the Divrei Shalom Emet. I just want to mention one cute thing about, you know, a tie into Pesach, and then we'll talk a little bit, for a few minutes we have left, we'll talk a little bit of how Purim moves from the Megillah to the Purim that we know of today, very briefly. What's the first thing we eat at the Seder? Karpas. Where does karpas come from? Where else does karpas appear in Tanakh? It's the first chapter of the Megillah. Achashverosh's party. Chur karpas utechelet. It's some fancy schmancy stuff. Whatever it is, chur karp. Look in the first chapter of Megillah. I don't believe anything I say. Just look in, no, I don't never believe anything I say. The true matter, it really is true. I mean, in other words, I read things sometimes you have to look it up because, and I do the same thing. When I explain what Rashi or somebody says, I'm explaining it with my interpretation within what they're saying. Sometimes they don't say exactly what I say, what they say. But okay, I try to be as honest as I can. Chur karpas utechelet. So right, what does it say? How does it translate in English? Verse 6. Chapter 1, verse 6, karpas, so right?
The place was decorated with expensive fabrics, white linen, green cotton. Now, green cotton is the karpas.
Karpas, okay. And now, we have it as a food. On Pesach, it's a food, but in the Megillah, it's not a food. It's now, Rashi.
Rashi, yes, with Yosef's
cup. There you go. Our first class Yosef. Purim Yosef. Basul, Yaakov makes for his son a ketonet pasim, right? He makes him a ketonet pasim. So what does Rashi say a ketonet pasim is? Kamo karpas utechelet. A ketonet pasim is like, you know what? The Megillah, karpas utechelet. What's Rashi doing? He just brought together Yosef, the Megillah, you know, Purim, Pesach, and Yosef are now all tied in together. Now, I just noticed, that's famous. I'm famous. I mean, that I've known for a while. But I just noticed it literally an hour ago when I was sort of going over last minute thing for the shiur. It never hit me before. So thank you. Obviously, you learn the most from your students. What does the Megillah say? I highlighted it before. Divrei Shalom Be'emet. Doresh Tov Lamo V'Dover Shalom L'Chol Zaro. Right? He spoke peace to his brothers. Divrei Shalom Be'emet. How does the Torah describe the brothers of Yosef? The relationship. When the brothers, Yosef, you know, their father showing favoritism to Yosef. The brother saw he loves him. He couldn't speak to him in peace. I think the Megillah is picking up on this, I think. Divrei Shalom. They couldn't speak peace. But Mordechai speaks peace to all the brothers. I think it's clear. And the tie into Karpas and everything. I don't know, but it seems pretty clear to me. Now, one last point, and then we'll talk a little bit about Purim, and then if you have any questions, whatever, after 5 weeks, I hope you have a lot of questions. Okay. Mordechai, of course, is Ratzui L'Rav Echav. The last verse, Mordechai di Mishneh L'Melech Achashverosh. He's the second in command to the king Achashverosh. Gadol LaYehudim. He's big among the Jews. I mean, Mordechai is the big hero. Ratzui, he's beloved. The majority of the Jewish people like Mordechai. He would get elected with 54% of the vote. Mordechai, Ratzui L'Rav Echav. L'Rav Echav. What does that mean? Ratzui L'Rav Echav. So the rabbis pick up on this. I said, lots of people didn't like Mordechai. Why do we have Purim? So if that idiot would have bowed down to Haman, we wouldn't have gotten this mess in the first place. This Mordechai, he's a little bit too aggressive. He's too involved in politics. He should be giving shiurim. He's a Rosh Yeshiva. He should be going to a rabbi getting involved in politics. What a Mordechai guy. They didn't like him. He created the problem. And the rabbis say, you know who separated from him? The Sanhedrin. The other rabbis didn't like Mordechai. Maybe the people liked Mordechai. The rabbis, they weren't so keen on Mordechai. In other words, you hear, we mentioned it many, many times, the tension already. Because what do you mean a holiday mishteh? the Simcha, right? The Jewish people celebrating Mishteh Simcha. They have merit. We have to add Matanot Lov Yanim, right? But it's very interesting. Now, you come. So that's how the Megillah ends. And the Megillah ends. We're going into Pesach already. Okay, the time to Pesach. What happens when you open up a Talmud? When you open up the Talmud? So this... So first of all, what's the Masech, what's the tractate about Purim called?
Megillah.
It's called Megillah. It's not called Purim. Where it's called, there's a tractate in the Talmud known as, you know, Psachim. There's one known as Rosh Hashanah. There's one known as Sukkah. And there's one known as Yuma. Yuma, that day. Or Yom Kippur, that's like a... But somehow, Purim, we don't call it Purim. In other words, I could have called Masech Psachim Masechet Haggadah. Right? That's the same thing. The tractate of the Haggadah. No, it's a tractate about Pesach. But tractate Megillah is not about Purim. It's about the Megillah. Because the rabbis, in a certain sense, wanted to shift the focus away from the partying to a serious day of study. And when I mentioned the first class, Yom Kippur is like Purim. So this is part of it. This Yom Kippur is a very serious day. The rabbis say Yom Kippur, not the day we re-accepted the Torah. We broke the Torah on the 17th of Tammuz, 40 days, 17th of Tammuz, 40 days after we got it. For 80 days, Moshe is praying for forgiveness. The 80th day after the 17th of Tammuz, calculate the days. It's the 10th of Tishrei. We didn't call it Yom Kippur. That's the day we got the Torah. Yom Kippur is the day of receiving the Torah. It's a very serious day that we got the Torah. So the rabbis are sort of shifting the focus. The Mishnah never, ever mentions the mitzvah to have a meal. Never mentions anything about drinking. Not mentioned at all. No, so the Mishnah only talks about Mikra Megillah and Matanot Levyonim. And the Gemara links them. Gemara says, when you read the Megillah, the poor people, remember we said we do Purim in Adar Beit because we want to link it to Pesach. Gemara says you do Purim, you do the Megillah and Matanot Levyonim in Adar Beit. You had the meal already a month ago, you don't have to have the meal again. It's like an amazing thing. In other words, remember when the calendar wasn't fixed, so I observed Purim the 14th of the first month of Adar. And then a week later, they decide to make a second month of Adar, right? They would decide the last minute. So now it's the 14th of Adar 2. So the normal thing, I already read the Megillah, I don't have to do it again. And there is an opinion like that on Talmud. You already did it, forget it. But that's not what we follow. We follow, you have to reread the Megillah. You have to reread the Megillah, but you don't have to redo the meal. You don't even have to redo Mishloach Manot, but you do have to redo Matanot Levyonim. Because the Gemara says, when the poor people are attuned, Purim, give a lot of charity, the poor people are attuned. Just the last thing may I say is, so in the Mishnah, there's nothing about drinking. Now in the Talmud, in the Gemara, they do talk about it. There's a debate. I for sure you can't get drunk. I don't want to get into a thing. That's clear. I mean, there are people, unfortunately, people sometimes get drunk on Purim, but that's like totally against you know Jewish law. It's impossible to believe. But what's the idea of drinking? I mean, what's the idea? Why is there a mitzvah to drink? And it's the same reason there's a mitzvah to wear masks. Because what happens when you drink? Nichnas yayin. Yes, sir. In goes wine, out goes all the secrets. Purim is this the holiday about revealing what's inside. Megillat Esther, everything is hidden. The rabbis are trying to reveal something much deeper here. Remember that we started the first class, for those who remember, I don't know if I remember, the first class, that Purim is the story of the Jew in exile when there's no God. Not no God, God forbid. Where God is not manifest. We don't feel God. There's no prophets. There's no... We don't feel it. That's the story of Purim. It's hidden. Like, we don't know what to do. It's the job of the rabbis to reveal what we're supposed to do. The rabbis become, our sages become our leaders. Drinking is about revealing what's inside. Now, when a Jew drinks, we hope, like Rabban Gamliel had the famous thing, Ishat vi tocho kaboro. Your inside should be like your inside. Rabban Gamliel, when he was the head of the academy, only let people, he had a very elitist institution of learning, which other people disagree with. I only want people that are inside like they're outside. We don't want any hypocrites. None of us are inside like the outside. That's very hard to do. But that's what Purim is about. The true Jew, the really deeply committed Jew, can get drunk, in a sense. We're not afraid what he's going to say. And we put on a mask because mask is all about hiding who we are, hiding. That's what Purim's all about, hiding our identity. So these little silly customs, you know, in a certain sense, become very important. The Rama, Ramosha Isserlis, who's the father of Ashkenazic Jewry. People here, the Rama River in Krakow in a shul. Ramosha Isserlis lived 1530 to 1572. He died a young man. But he wrote that's what he said on the two parts of the Shulchan Aruch. The Rav Yosef Karo, the Sephardi, living in Spain, then in Egypt, then in Israel. I don't know if he was in Egypt, actually, now I forget. He wrote the Shulchan Aruch, and what made the Shulchan Aruch accept is the Rama wrote his comments. So the Rama, at the end, writes that customs in the Jewish people are very important. And you should never make fun of a custom. Every custom in Judaism, and what's the custom he chooses to make the statement of the importance of customs? The custom to Haman, we bang and says, so that's like, you know, it makes noise. It's the opposite of what, come to shul. So one day we encourage you to make noise in shul. People are like the minak so much, they make noise every day in shul. But the real custom is to make noise only on Purim. To make noise, not to pay attention, right? So the Rama, it's a beautiful, the idea of banging out Haman, blotting out Haman. But really, Purim has become, we need both. The people, they have the Mishteh on top, and the rabbis can bring Matanat Lev Yonim, and Mishloach Manot. We only scratch the surface, I hope, a little bit. There's a lot more here. You know, we read a few verses here, a few verses there, but I tried to give an overview of really what's an unbelievable story. Megillat Esther is so deep. Because it's hidden, because there's so many layers to read the Megillah on, and different ways to read the Megillah. I want to thank everybody for coming and participating, and tell me what you didn't like, so we can improve for the next time. And if I may, I'll invite everybody. If you want to get, I write the Divrei Torah every week, all the time. If anyone wants to get on my email list, I invite you all to join. Go to Torah in Motion. Just type in TorahMotion.org. See, join our mailing list. If you don't like it, you'll unsubscribe. But I send out on the Parsha every week. I send out a Torah on the Parsha. And then I write once or twice a week on Daf Yomi for people who are not learning Daf Yomi. It's written for people on Talmud ideas, whatever. If anybody wants to join our email list, I welcome you to join. I have to put in a little plug somewhere. Okay? And I want to thank you guys for hosting. Very much.
I'll send an email to everyone giving you that link so you can link up if you want to read the Divrei Torah every week. They're fantastic. And also, I'll let you know when the next time we're going to be hanging together again. Hopefully, you'll be
Loomer's soon. Learning.
Al's learning. Loomer and Laura.
There you go.
He's doing this so he doesn't have to pay taxes.
That's
a religious institution.
Lower the taxes. Yeah, our budget's coming up tomorrow. That's right. Just like we'll see if we have a Hashverosh. What do we have? Lower tax the rich. Lower the middle. They didn't have that back then. Everybody got taxed. They didn't have progressive tax rates. I don't think they have that in Shushan. No progressive tax rate. Yes.
There has been changes to the Haggadah over the years.
Sure.
Is this from day one?
So, okay, that's an excellent point. The Haggadah is not a canonized text. It's not part of our Bible, so who cares what you say? It's like our Siddur. Our Siddur doesn't have any holiness. So, I mean, the Siddur is really something quasi-negative because prayer is supposed to come from the heart. And it's about that. You can't tell a person what his heart is supposed to say. The rabbis only instituted a Siddur because people didn't have a clue what to do. They gave you instructions and said, do it quietly so you can add your own prayer. You can change the prayers. You don't have to say all the prayers. You can do what you want. Jewish law has developed a certain structure. The Haggadah, you don't have to say everything in the Haggadah. We skip sometimes. It's really like Rabbi Yossi Akalili. I skipped that, okay. Now, I mean, Rabbi Akalili, what the main parts of the Haggadah. You can add some. I don't need to skip. Because we add so many things, so much to the Haggadah. Sometimes it's so late. You know, whatever. But the Haggadah, there's a mitzvah to tell the story of Egypt. So the rabbis, most of what we do at Pesach is not telling the story. Most of it is the warm-up to the story. The four children, that's not the story. That's not the main part. You have to ask questions. So the Haggadah, there's a lot of freedom to do what you want. So now the core text of the Haggadah has not changed in 1800 years. I mean, there have probably been additions. Like we added, when I was, my father always used to add the second night of reading on the Warsaw Ghetto Upright, he's rising. There's a special bit, and we used to do for now, it's, we don't do it anymore, on Russian Jewry for the Jews behind the Iron Curtain. So the Haggadah, I remember when I was in Yeshiva University, Rabbi Tendler, who was the, he's still Baruch Hashem alive, he's in his 90s, he's the head of the biology department, and a professor, and he was a Rebbe of Talmud and the head of the biology department, the son-in-law of Rav Moshe Feinstein, the greatest halakhic authority ever lived in America. Remember Rabbi Tendler said, it was in the 80s, you should be talking, as you say, about the Iran-Iraq war. In words, what do we learn from the Iran-Iraq? In other words, b'chol dor v'dor chayav adam liron et atzmo kilu hu yatzam mitzrayim. And every generation, if we left Egypt. So we have to make that kind of relevant to us. Mm-hmm. We have to talk about current events at the Seder. Mm-hmm. So the text of the Haggadah is not, I mean, I'm not saying to skip the text, but it's not that important. And if you want to skip, if you, it's much better to focus, yeah, of course, the four questions, the main part of the Haggadah is the part that people like skip the most, because it's the most boring part. When we read the part on the Bikurim, on the first, Arami Oved Avi, Vayeri Mitzrayim, Malame, Shayim Mitzuyim, Shayim, that whole stuff in the middle. That's a whole other shir. There are really many stories within that Gada. So the text of the Gada changes. The Megillah text, we assume today, in, as a matter of Jewish law, very interesting, that you're supposed to hear every single word of the Megillah. You don't really have that by reading of the Torah. Even reading the Torah is considered a communal, whatever. According to many authorities, when we read the Parshat HaShavua every week, that's really an individual obligation. The community, the Jewish people, have to read the Torah every year as a people. There's certainly when the Chazan repeats the Shmon Esrei, he's not. What does that mean? It means the community is davening as a whole, and the Chazans are representative. It's not me. So Kriyas HaTorah is the community. Megillah and Esther is an individual obligation. That's why you all know. I think if you don't go to shul, I used to read when I had little kids at home. I'd come home read for my wife at home. No, we don't have a minyan, we don't have anything. You can read the Megillah for a lot of shuls will do a later minyan, you know, for people with little kids. They'll have a second late Megillah reading after at night. But every individual, Megillah reading is not a communal, I mean, it may also be, but it's not a communal obligation, it's an individual obligation. So as an individual obligation, we have to read every word. Kriyas HaTorah, interesting, if you miss shul one week, as long as the community, it's nice for you to be there. But as long as the community has read the Torah, the community's fulfilled its obligation. So the Megillah text has not changed. I'm not aware of any variations in any text of the Megillah. But the Haggadah also doesn't change, but the Haggadah text doesn't, like our Siddur, doesn't, can change around. I mean, Ashkenazim and Sephardim have different texts of the Siddur. And I'm sure the Sephardic Haggadah, that's actually what I'm talking about. I don't know the Sephardic Haggadah, but I imagine it is different. The Sephardic Kinon are different. The Slichas are different. Everything like that is all different. The Yemenites do it one way, the Ashkenaz in Germany, they did it this way, in Poland, this way, the Russia that way. That's great. Minhagim. The importance, everybody keeps their own customs.
Does the Sephardim read it the same way?
Yeah, but anything that's of the biblical text is the same. There are 9 minor differences in the Sefer Torah with the Vav here and there between. We don't have the exact version of even the Sefer Torah. There are very minor differences, but it's. It's semi-significant, although it's like a Vav here, this Torah, the Yemenite customs up this one, that one. Rabbi Akiva Eiger lists off a whole place that where the Talmud says this, our Torah say that. But they're all like a Vav or something, nothing significant. But because it's very hard, it was a handwritten tradition, there are going to be errors in transmitting the text. But as far as I know, the Megillah is the same everywhere. Okay, everybody's so quiet.
Why the obligation to hear it twice?
So that's later. That's an excellent question. The obligation here, Megillah, I think about, is only in the daytime. The real obligation is only in the daytime. Then, because the Megillah, I'll tell you another interesting halacha. When you make Kiddush, I think this happens a lot at the Seder. So you got 94 people at your Seder. So what do you do? Everyone's going to make Kiddush. So everyone makes Kiddush all together. Right? We make Kiddush all together. So, that's a problem if 14 people make Kiddush and 9 people are listening. A problem. It's not really right. Why not? Because it's very hard to listen to. When 14 people speak or 3 people speak, even if they're saying the same things, they don't say it in unison. Do you know that the original custom was to say Kiddush? Only one person was allowed to
That's
say
right.
Kiddush.
They still do it the in Belgium.
The mourners Kiddush. Where?
I was in Brussels, St. Cutter's.
Only one person. Because if two people, you know, this one gets to the Yehashmi Rabbah before. You see it all the time. People in the front, they're here all the time. So that's not really right. But you know what? Divrei shalom v'emet. The shalom is more important. Can you imagine the fights that would go on in shul? Who gets to say Kaddish today? Mm-hmm. So the Rebbe said, forget it. Everybody say Kaddish. But trei koli lo mishtai. Two voices can't be heard together like properly. So you're not really, if you're saying something out loud, one person should say and everybody should listen, or everybody can say it. But you shouldn't have half the people saying and half the people listening. Megillat Esther is an exception. Talmud says, Megillat Esther, because everybody loves the story, so they really pay attention carefully. So even if the voices are not, you know, calibrate, they're still listening. Kiddush, you know, you're talking, you're not really paying attention. So the Megillah is a beloved book. So the custom developed, I mean, the Talmud mentions, they quote, why, whatever, to read it a second time. The second time's at night. The problem we have is way more people go to shul at night than in the day. It's more important to go to shul in the day than at night. So if you can only go once, go in the day, don't go at night. I'm not telling you not to go at night, but the daytime reading is the reading of the rabbis. The Megillah at night is not mentioned in the Mishnah either. Just like the suit isn't mentioned, drinking, the reading at night is not mentioned. The Gemara mentions that there's a custom to read it at night also. But the main Megillah, because the Megillah is so beloved, we like to read it again. Okay, it's getting late. I'm happy to stay and answer any private questions, but thank you very much again, and Lila Talk. Okay.